The church has three documents with the word vitae, of life, attached to it. Umani vitae, donum vitae, evangelium vitae. Umani vitae, of human life, was produced by 1968, July 25th, Pope Paul VI. Donum vitae, the gift of life, was February 22nd, 1987. And the one who signed that was Cardinal Ratzinger. Right? And Cardinal Ratzinger, God approved the document by making him Pope Benedict XVI. Okay? So you don't go against that one. And the third one is Evangelium Vitae, March 25th, 1995, by John Paul II, the Gospel of Life. Now the question is this, why do you need three documents on life? Wouldn't one be sufficient? Well, the reason why you need three, because we have a living church and a living society, a changing society. So the church has to respond to what's happening at any given moment. So the documents are taking place over like 40 years. And so the church is responding to it. Now, in what way? Well, in 1968, what was under attack was marriage. The whole concept of marriage. That human life should be conceived in the context of a home, a man and a woman, a loving relationship. What was under attack was the process of creating human life, the process of procreation. And Paul VI had to respond to that. He had to reaffirm what was the difficulty. Now, in his encyclical, section 7, he talks about a need for total vision. And the total vision is absolutely necessary to get wisdom. If you don't see the whole, you cannot understand the parts. Or if you make a judgment about an individual action on the parts and not the whole, your moral judgment will be incorrect. Let me give you an example. There's different type of literary genres that if you go into a library, you go into different areas. Part is history, part is poetry, part is fiction, biography. There's different types of genres. It's important to know what genre you're reading to understand something properly. Right? That's the first thing. But there is a genre called epic, the epic genre, right? Which is the one that provides really wisdom. The epic genre is where you have the great writers and poets in history, from Homer, the Iliad and the Odyssey, from Virgil, the Aeneid, from Dante, the Divine Comedy, from Milton, Paradise Lost, Paradise Found, you see. That's all written in the epic genre. And when you have an epic genre, what happens is this. The poet begins by asking for inspiration from the gods, from the muse. Inspire me, O God, that I may understand, you see, what we're about to write about. And then the poet raises profound questions. He raises questions like fate, freedom. Can you have the two? Whereas, can you be free if there is an ordered plan? If there is an ordered plan, is there freedom? Now, the Greeks, the word for order, okay, it's interesting. A woman goes into the drugstore, see? And she says, she doesn't say this, she says, I'm a bit of a mess, okay? Would you give me some cosmetics so I can undo this mess, okay? Because it's sort of chaotic. You see, what do you mean chaotic? Well, the word cosmetic comes from cosmos, which means ordered, as opposed to disorder. Right? So cosmetics is put in order. But the ancient Greeks, Latin civilizations, believed that there was an ordered universe. There was an ordered universe. And part of the job of wisdom was to find out where you fit into the order. At the same time, they did believe in the responsibility of the individual for his actions. Individual for his actions. So you now have this audit reality, or what we call the fates. And if you overstress that, you have fatalism. And many writers will write that way. Everything's fated. No one's free. You can't get out of the system. You're locked in. Okay? On the other hand, if you overemphasize freedom, you deny the order. You deny that there is an audit reality. And the pendulum tends to swing back and forth. When you read history, you read literature and so forth, what you have an emphasis on audit, and then they have like totalitarian communist systems in which no one has freedom. It's audit reality, see? And then you have the swing from that, like our society, which is a reaction to communism, Nazism, you see, the Mussolini, all these things. What is it? We emphasize freedom of choice. Freedom without even asking, is there an ordered reality? Is there a limitation that one has to respect? You see, you can buy a balloon for a party, and you start to design on the balloon, you start to blow it up, and when you blow up, it looks nice. You put the balloons up, everything's set for the party. But if you say, well, I can put as much air into this balloon as I want. I said, well, no, really, not really. If you went into a gas station and you wanted to fill up the tire, it's good to take a look and see what the maker of the tire tells you, how much air pressure you can put in there. You say, no, I put as much air as I want, my freedom of choice. I say, fine, but I'm leaving. See? You can go and fill up the tire yourself. Right? And you blow up the tire, you kill yourself. The balloon explodes. Because there are limitations based on how you are made, how the maker made you. There is an ordered reality, like it or not. See? At the same time, you are free. You are free. Freedom is a reality. And you have to try to balance these two. At our present time, we emphasize the absoluteness of freedom. Freedom of choice. And anything in the law that would say there's a limitation, there's an order, there's what we call a value, is removed. And everybody's able to do or told to do whatever you want. And we destroy. It's self-destructive. We perish. See? It's because, and it's this going back and forth. So that the reality is that things are fated. There is a plan. There is an order. And you have to look it up and search it out and find it. And you can do it with your reason. Because when you get anything, you buy a computer, you buy this, a machine, and so the first thing you do is you try to figure it out, or you get the directions from the person who made it, and you follow it, you get the best out of it. If you don't, it's sitting there, it's useless. You don't know what you're doing. Okay? So we do that normally, naturally. We don't say, oh, I can do whatever I want. Yeah, you can, but that computer's going to sit there and be wasted for the rest of your life. And you know what? You don't have to figure it all out. There's directions come with it. Read the directions. They did you a favor. We tend to do that and accept that outside things outside of ourselves, but at the present time, we don't do that in regards to ourselves. That a life that is wisely lived is a reflective life. If you don't have a person who is reflective, watch out. Either useless or they're dangerous. Right? A reflective life is where you start to turn. See, reflective means to bend back on oneself. Reflection, okay? To bend back on oneself, and you start to reflect not just on the world out there, but the world here. Who am I? Why am I here? What is my nature? Why am I made? What is the final purpose of myself and my existence, you see? How do I act to bring that about? See, There's a Latin saying in philosophy, axio sequitur ends, okay? The action follows the being, okay? In other words, according to how a thing is, the action should flow from that. And when they do, then you achieve the purpose for which a thing is made, and you reach perfection. If it is not in accordance to what you are, what you are, your nature, then you are going to self-destruct. Anyways, put it another way, is to say, your freedom of movement ends where my nose begins. I used to say that, but can't say it these days. I have to get another example. but the reality is that you are limited by reality. You don't like that, you're going to find out. Just touch my nose. In society, we put you in jail. This is the thing. Now, so what happens is this, is that trying to balance these two has always been throughout history, and reflected most especially in literature, this struggle between order and freedom. Fatalism, you see, and a type of the ode to the skylark. You see this almost poetic freedom. Everybody should be able to do what they want. Usually there is a reaction. There is a reaction according to, if there was over suppression, we tend to, the pendulum swings to over freedom. What's going to happen now is going to be a pendulum back. A pendulum back from freedom in which this, only the strong survive. The weak do not. In when you're emphasizing freedom. So what has happened in your lifetime is there's been a constant push to remove anything in the law that would restrict anyone's freedom. In other words, if there's any values in the... Now what happened used to be this. The customs that you learn the most, the mores, customs, you learn, first of all, in your family. There's this way we do things. There's this practice that we have. And in that family tradition, you're learning wisdom. It's handed on down by how the family acts, what they do. Not in this house, it's the way we do it. You see, God is given first place. We have this, and so forth. See? Now, besides the family, society has learned over a period of history, time, what things enable us to relate to each other correctly. Called the mores, the morals. And what they would do is they would take those basic things that are necessary for survival, for stability in society, and they put them into the law. And what was put into the law for so many centuries were the values that came from Judaic Christian ethics. And so the laws had within them this Judaic Christian and actually a Greek and Roman ethics. That's what's made Western civilization great. What they are doing at the present time is removing every value in the law to allow the absolute freedom. And that ultimately is self-destructive. Because you can only put so much air in the tire, so much air in the balloon, and if you don't stop where my nose begins, then it becomes the survival of the strongest and of the fittest, and the weak just get wiped out. Wiped out. Now, in the epic genre, the writer usually asks questions. Oh, muse, tell me, is there an ordered reality? Is the fates real? Do the fates determine everything? Right? And if they do, then how are we free? But it seems we are free. And when chaos and suffering come into the world, then the muse asks, what is the nature of God that would allow such evil, such suffering in the world? What is God like? Right? And why does one civilization fall, another replace it? what is this current of history? You see, how do you fit into this? How do you understand this whole these profound questions of who are you? Where have you come from? Where are you going? How are you going to get there? Right? I'm not asking for your social security. I'm not asking for your home address. Right? I ask you much more profound questions when I say, who are you? Where have you come from? Where are you going? How are you going to get there? I don't want your social security. I don't want to say, tell me you're not from Catholic University. I want none of those answers. I want to know, who are you? Where have you come from? Where are you going? How are you going to get there? Very, very important questions to keep reflecting on. Okay? Now, what the epic writer does, having asked the profound questions, the epic writer starts to tell a story. Once there was a man called Aeneas, and he went from Troy to Rome, and he starts to tell the story of Aeneas. Or Homer starts to tell about Achilles and Odysseus and so forth, you see? And so they tell the story, and it's very interesting. And each part of the story, each episode, each book, is entertaining in itself and seems to be almost complete. However, you cannot learn wisdom by only reading part. You must read the whole story. And people say you can't tell the trees from the forest, the forest from the trees. What does that mean? It means this. If you, I'll give you an example. In the book, The Aeneid, by Virgil. Virgil, the Latin writer, wrote a book called The Aeneid. Famous, famous work. Okay? There is a hero called Aeneas. He is a survival from the city of Troy, Trojan civilization. And he wants to establish a new Troy. It's going to be Rome. And there's another person called Dido, okay, who is a survival also, and she wants to establish a new Carthage. See? They're two great leaders, but they've suffered much. They've been wiped out. Their loved ones and so forth, and they've gone into exile, and they're now establishing a new civilization, which they are to be the queen of the king. Okay, many people have left and gone with them. And the Aeneid opens up with Aeneas on the last step of his journey going to Italy, to Italia. And he's going to Latium. And he's going to establish, finally, a new Troy called, which will be Rome. Okay? And the last part of their journey, they're going, and there is other dimensions here. See, always next to time, there is eternity. And in the epic genre, it's the gods and goddesses. In other words, you have Juno and Venus. It goes back to the whole mythology where Juno, it's funny, Paris, okay, who took Venus away, okay, took Helen away from Troy, to Troy, okay, from the Greeks. There was a contest, and the contest was amongst the gods, Minerva, Venus, and Juno. Minerva, wisdom, and Juno, power, and Venus, love. Right? And this young fella called Paris had to choose between the three. They wanted Jupiter, the old god, to make the decision. And he said, "You are out of your minds. I'm going to make a decision. Which one of these three women, okay, these three goddesses, is superior to the other? You'd have to be a fool to do that. Find some young fool to do that, okay?" So they found Paris, the young fella. Okay? And Paris was asked, which does he choose? And the three goddesses tried to bribe him. Minerva said, if you choose me, I will give you wisdom that all the world will admire you. Okay? And Juno said, you choose me, I'll make you the most powerful, powerful person on the face of the earth. And Venus says, you choose me, I'll give you the most beautiful woman in the world. Well, being a young fella, this hard decision, you see, it took him about 20 seconds to choose Venus. Because it comes late. Wisdom, okay, power. That comes later. See, when people pass, you know, the young love stage, then they want power, okay? And only last do they come to wisdom. It should be the reverse, okay? That's what it should be. But anyway, so what happens is this, mythologically, this is sort of the background to the story. But the point is that on one side is what happened was Paris took Helen to Troy, called Helen of Troy. And because she was taken, the Greeks were Agamemnon, the leader of the Greeks, their Greek pride was insulted. And they had to go back and get Helen from the Trojans. And they went, but Achilles would not go with them. So eventually they had to get Achilles to do it. But what happened is that you have then Venus protecting Troy, it's Achilles, and then the Greeks, you have Juno protecting Juno. And so there's a battle amongst the gods. And so when Aeneas is on his last step to go into Italy, Juno is upset. I don't want Troy to rise up again. So she gets the god of the winds, Aeolus. And she asked the god of the winds, if you'd stir up the winds from all over the face of the earth and take their ships and blast them and put them out in drowning in the sea. So everything is going, it's just about ready to happen. And he goes, and he's going to go there. And what happens, this incredible storm comes and drives him away from Italy to northern Africa, Libya, to Carthage. And they crash there, and they got nothing. And that's how the story opens. The hero is with nothing. Totally depressed, hopeless. And he starts to, in this area, it's like a desert, there's nothing there. And he starts with his few men to go to see if there's any type of life. And suddenly he comes to a place where Dido had arrived before him and was setting up a new city, a new civilization. He's absolutely shocked to find it. So what happens is Dido and Aeneas are similar. They have suffered. He's young and handsome. She's young and beautiful. They come from noble families. They're lonely and so forth. It's a normal, natural thing that they fall in love and get married, so to speak. They're both widowers, okay? One problem. She is supposed, according to the fates, establish Carthage and to be the leader of the people. Aeneas, according to the fates, is to establish Rome. And her people have followed her there, and his people have followed him, not to Carthage, but to Rome. Okay? But you can see it's happening. What happens is he's worn down by the suffering, the disappointment, and so forth. And in both of them, it's almost a natural thing. They get involved. And when they get involved, the Carthage is suffering. The people are suffering. They don't have the leadership of the queen. And Aeneas' men are saying, we left home, we left our families to come here to be with this queen. What's going on? We want to go to Rome. You see? So you have the situation where... it's the Pope. somebody's calling. It's the wrong number, though. Hello? Yes? I think you have the wrong number. I have to shut it off. Okay. She keeps calling again and again, you know? Goodbye. Okay. That's one way. That's one good thing. See, this is better than a wife because you can just shut it off. Try to do that with your wife, you're dead. Okay. Now, what happens is this. I don't want to lose my train of thought here. This is important. You got to catch this. So what happens is the two of them fall in love, and both are neglecting their ultimate goal that they've been called to achieve, according to the fates. Okay, to establish Rome, to establish Carthage. And finally, Aeneas is becoming very weak. He's not leaving, and his men are upset. In the middle of the night, Venus, who wants Rome, she goes to the head of the gods, Jupiter, And she says, you got to get my son free from Juno's grasp by Dido. Get him out of there. So okay, he said, okay, I'll do it. He sends Mercury, the messenger of the gods, Mercury, and he appears in the middle of the night to Aeneas. And all of a sudden he says, what are you doing here? What kind of a man have you become? What kind of a leader are you? See? Get out of here. Now, he had these feelings very strong towards Dido. It was not easy for him to do it, because any time he delayed, he'd get sucked right into it. He couldn't do it. You see? He was weak. But so, and she said to him, if you leave me, I'll kill myself. That's always a great line. Okay, fine. But she says that, if I can't live with you, I won't be able to live without you. So that really puts a old guilt complex on the fella, this type of thing. So what happens is, he gets this special grace, and he, in the middle of the night, his men have been waiting for him to break loose. Right? In the middle of the night, he says, he's so shocked by himself that this God has appeared to him and said, get out of here, what has happened to you? And he gets the grace, I'll do it immediately, now. And his men load up the boats within 20 minutes. Everything's set, out to the sea they go. They just take them, put them in, and go. See? And so what happens is that Dido wakes up, and she the next morning, and she sees all these sails on the horizon. And she says, what's that? And then she looks down, and the whole shore where the Trojan ships were, they're gone. She said, he left. He will not do that to me or our people. I'll kill him. See, she was supposed to kill herself. But she forgot all about that. She's going to go kill Aeneas. And she says, I'll drag out my army, we'll get him, and we'll kill every last one of them. Then she comes to a sense of, what am I saying? What am I doing? Why should I kill my people? It's I, you see? I should not make them suffer for what I have done, you see? I will take my life. Now, in the beginning of the book, Anna is her sister. Anna is the sister of Dido. And Anna, when Dido had fallen in love in the past, she knew she was not, because of the circumstance, to fall in love with Aeneas, because they had two fated different goals, purposes, that were not compatible. And so what happened is, Anna, she starts to cry. She says, I know the feelings, it's happening to me again. And Anna is a weak person. A weak person, whenever you see tears, to stop the tears, you tell the person what they want to hear, and what to stop the tears. No good friend. Weak. Dump them. You have to tell the person what they need to hear, even if they cry the rest of the day. You see? There's a difference. Even if they cry the rest of the day. But she didn't. She wanted Dido to stop crying, so she told her what she wanted to hear. It's okay, this case, etc., etc., etc. See? And then they got involved in the relationship, and then all of a sudden he's leaving, and she's going to take her life. Now what happens is, as she's about to, has this funeral pyre, building up the thing, where they would burn themselves to death in the past, because they didn't have, embalming and things like that. So Anna walks in, and she sees her sister on top of this funeral pyre about to kill herself. Right? She said, what are you doing? And she says, I'm going to take my life. She said, why? And she turns, on Anna. She said, you brought all this upon me. When I was weak, and I needed the truth, I needed someone to be strong, and you were not involved emotionally as I was, you gave me the wrong answers. You were weak and you led me. It is you who have killed me. Curse you. Very interesting. And she kills herself. And Anna is there like in total shock. Her sister has just died in her presence. And she was cursed by her sister for bringing this evil upon her, for not telling her the truth, not being strong when she needed to hear the truth. That happens, my friends, over and over and over again in the area of abortion. Family members, friends, weak, weak, weak. And the woman ends up taking the life of her child, And she ends up cursing the people. Cursing them. Who should have said, don't you do it, be strong. There's another answer, it's not the answer. Every day I deal with that. Every single day. Because you see, I speak to the woman not only before the abortions, we're out there 4 to 6 hours every day. I speak to them after the abortions. They curse that fella. You think that relationship is sound? That relationship is dead in the water between the fellow and the girl. Absolutely dead. Even if they stay together, it's dead. And the family and all who brought her there did not tell her. The doctor, the people there, everything's gone south. You see? She has been taken and exploited by everybody. No one was strong. So when you're out there and you're getting flack, don't worry about it. You are the one she'll bless later. She'll bless later. When she keeps that child, she'll come back and they're going to thank you for praying, for counseling, for being there. More than her husband, more than her father, more than her children, any of them, okay? But to do that, you have to be willing for the moment to take the flack. You have to be willing to let them cry. You have to let them feel sorry for themselves. All of those things, fine. But speak the truth. Maintain the truth. Why? Because you keep the whole picture in focus. Namely, what happens? Aeneas is going off to the sea. As he's going off to the sea, he looks back and he sees this fire is burning on the shore. He didn't know it was Dido killing herself. He goes off. Now, if the story ended right there, you would say, who is... Your whole sympathy would be with Dido. You'd hate Aeneas. Correct? How could he have done this? How could he leave? The poor thing kills herself. Okay? Now, it's only in the light of the whole story that you can make a proper judgment. Namely, Aeneas should not got her involved, nor should she got involved with Aeneas. That was wrong. Him doing this and now leaving, it's caused great harm. Okay? On the other hand, if he stays there, okay, the great civilization of Rome will never come to be. He has to leave. He has to leave because it's the plan, the design of the gods. And he has to obey it. Otherwise, the civilization of Rome and all the laws and all the good that's going to come into the world because of it will be lost. But it is wrong that he should have stayed with her, but it is not wrong that he should leave her. You follow? And it's only when you read the whole story that you can understand the individual episodes and the parts properly. See? So if you try to make a judgment on whether a person should have an abortion, we'll say from the point of view, say, of health. Or in point of view, say, of financial. Or the point of view of she's too young, she's too old. In other words, you're taking individual parts and making a moral judgment. That judgment will be wrong. Because it doesn't have a total vision. Doesn't have a full understanding, okay? The decision, a moral decision, should be based on who a person is, what life is about, how does this fit into the whole, okay? A total vision. Then you make an objective, proper decision on what's objectively, morally good or bad. What's best or not best. But today, all you get is a slice of life. You don't get the whole pie. All you get is these one after the other on TV, in the movies. You don't get to see the whole of life and the story. You get individual sections of life, the individual episodes, that moves you to tears but gives you no wisdom. Matter of fact, it can lead you astray. Lead you astray. So you have to say, where do I get wisdom from? Wisdom is incredibly important. Wisdom is incredibly important. To see the whole, to see what's right or wrong. Now, what other great book is written in the epic genre? Anybody? The Bible. Very important to know that. In other words, the individual episodes, individual books are written by different people at different times over a period of centuries. But there is a single writer called the Holy Spirit, God Almighty. And you cannot understand the story of Aeneas by reading an individual part. You have to read the whole, and when you read the whole, then you reevaluate the parts. In other words, if you walk into a movie and you see a particular part of it, you might think you understand it, but not until the movie is over can you understand the part. You say, I thought he was guilty. It wasn't him, it was the other person. Right? I thought he was the hero. He isn't. The other person is. See? In other words, in the light of the whole story. So you just can't walk into a movie and not have seen the beginning or the end. You're going to be misreading it. The Bible itself is written by God. And you only can understand the individual parts in the light of the whole story. It's salvation history. Salvation history. And in that is found the wisdom of God. In that is found the fullness of the truth. But you cannot just quote here or there or take parts. You have to see the whole and read the individual parts, understand them, but then you have to see the whole and reflect on the parts in the light of the whole. So, for example, the culture of death starts where? In the Bible. The book of Genesis. The book of Genesis. The devil inspired the culture of death. There's no limitations. God told you, don't do that, don't do this. He knows if you do, you'll be just like God. You know as much as God, you'll be like God, you won't die. Don't listen to limitations. Don't listen to there's an objective order out there that you're a creature and you're not the creator. When I tell you, it's two basic laws. You get it straight, you got the whole life straightened out. What's the two basic rules? One, there is a God. Two, it's not you. Okay? Now if you got that understood, you're in business. Okay? There is a God, it's not you. We believe it is, the modern world. We act like we are God. No, it's not. You get that thing straight, see? So what happens is that in the beginning of Genesis, the devil inspires our first parents to say that they're not creatures, they're the creator. They know as much as God, there's no limitations, do whatever you want. Right? Uh-huh. So they do. They disobey. And what happens? They end up dying. They end up being afraid of God. They end up losing everything for themselves and for us. For us. So that's the beginning of the story, to give light to the whole of the story, very beginning. But when did the culture of life, when was it promised? The culture of life.
The resurrection?
No. It's in the book of Genesis.
Oh.
The book of Genesis, first three chapters, four chapters, okay? Namely, after the fall, the devil tempting our parents, there's no limitations, do what you want, it's a whole nine yards. See? God said, I will send a woman, and her son shall crush the head of the serpent. The woman, of course, is Mary, and the son, of course, is Jesus. And you cannot establish a culture of life without Jesus and Mary. That's what we do. We sent on the blood of Jesus, the offering of the bears, and then Mary. I don't care how many others you have, you would not establish a culture of life except by the way that God said so to the woman and her son. When will that son come? Where was that woman going to be? Well, we know. The fullness of time, we call it fullness of time, when all this time of waiting was fulfilled, the messianic era has come to be, was the conception of Jesus. Conception of Jesus. And we know at the end of the story, what do you know at the end of the story? It's like Our Lady of Guadalupe at the end. Chapter 12, Book of Revelations, the Apocalypse. What do you have there? a woman in the heavens, the crown of stars around her head. And the serpent, the dragon, the evil one, tries to attack her offspring, who's going to crush his head. But not being able to crush him or her, he goes down to the earth to get the offspring of the son, of the woman. The battle between the kingdom of heaven and the kingdom of God for souls and eternal life is the overall constant struggle throughout the whole of salvation history, and it goes on today. Time is always paralleled by eternity, and they're interrupting each other. And if you don't understand that and see that, you're not wise. And anything that's happening must be seen in the light of the whole story. So in order to understand the scriptures, the Bible, you have to know the whole story. And knowing the beginning and the end gives you wisdom. In other words, when you know about Lady Apocalypse and you remember the woman whose son will crush the head of the serpent and establish the culture of life, the second new creation in Christ, the church, you see, then you understand it. But you can't, it's got to be in full of context. See? So, the Holy Father says, you cannot make judgments, moral judgments, in regards to what's right or wrong, okay, except in the context of the whole. Of the whole. Especially the area of morality in the sexual areas. You have to understand who is man, why is he here, the individual purposes. If you take it out of context, you cannot appreciate it. So what I'm going to do is I have for you, let me just, before I give this, okay? I'm going to have 50 minutes here. Okay. In 1968, what was under attack was that God created a family, a man and a woman loving each other, and out of the act of love, a human being should come into existence, a person who was to be forever, to enter into a union of love with the triune Godhead, with their parents and with others, as the purpose of sex. Isn't that magnificent? Magnificent. Whereas there is a visible and an invisible aspect of sex. The visible aspect is the union of love and life between a man and a woman. The invisible is the act of creation on the part of God. The invisible is what's going to come from this act, a human person that is forever, to be born into a union with the triune Godhead and to love his parents and others forever. This is incredible sex. It's beautiful. It's a union. Out of this act of love will come a human being, a human person. There's nothing better you can make. No buildings, no bridges, no nothing. Okay? That's the best. That is forever. Incredible mystery. Now, if you see that, then you can't take it and out of that context, namely eliminate the creative act of God, namely eliminate the possibility of new life, of a person. Of taking it out of the context of in family, an act of love between a man and a woman. You see, in other words, the sexual powers are powers that God gives to a person, and they are to be integrated into a person as a person. And you express yourself. See, it's very simple. Boy meets girl. They have a friendship. They like each other. But that doesn't mean marriage. They just like each other. Good friends. See? But as they go on, they become more one in mind, one in heart, one in affections, as a further attraction to each other. And then finally they said, well, I want to give myself totally to you, including my life-bearing powers, my fertility. I want to do that too. And I want to do it that out of this act, you see, out of this act of love, God willing, human life will come into existence. Now, the only way that you could give yourself totally to the other, namely to give your life-giving powers, is the sexual act. But that sexual act must be an act of love, of I want to give you my total self. If it's out of that context, something the matter. Okay? It's degraded. It's improper. See? It's in that context, then no one can replace you. Because the act of sexuality is not self-gratification. The act of sexuality is an act of love, of I for you and you for me. And there, that's the I and the you are irreplaceable. And out of this act of love, what does God intend? Only out of an act of love does he want human life to come into existence. God took the universe and brought it into existence because of love. There was absolutely no need to make us. None whatsoever on the part of God. The only reason you can explain why you are here is because God loves you. You're, every one of you is an expression of God's love. I see that. That's why I must treat you with respect. You are the result of love, God's love. And God, as he brought the universe creation itself into existence because of love, he wants human beings to be brought into existence out of an act of love. And the act of love is to be personal. I and a you. I love you, and then together with God, a human being is brought into existence. You see, a person does not make up, we do not create marriage. That's what we're doing today. We redefine marriage like it's man's creation. We make it what we want. A man, a woman, two dogs, whatever you want. Nonsense. Marriage is God's creation. God's creation. And what it is, he's calling, it exists whether you get married or not. The state of life of marriage itself exists whether you choose to enter into that state or not. You don't make it. State doesn't make it. That society is God's creation. God's creation. You understand? And if a person enters into this state of life, they are called by God to do so. And they're called by God to cooperate with God in bringing a new life into existence. It's an incredibly honorable thing, a beautiful thing. And when you came into existence, realize this, it required a special act of creation on the part of God, and the world was changed and never will be the same again since the moment of your existence. Because it wasn't just your lover, your mom, and your dad. It required a special act of creation on the part of Almighty God that you were brought into existence. So this act of sexuality, this mystery, this beautiful creation of God, is meant to be an act of love, man for woman, with incredible, invisible, marvelous consequences. Which in there is the living, creative act of the living God working with mom and dad to bring into existence a human being. See, a human being is not just a body. A human being is, you have a spiritual soul. Every single person is created separately, individually by God. And so what you have then is that sexuality, to be understood properly, should be seen in the context of it is a special language of the body by which a man is saying to a woman is saying to a man, I love you, I want to give myself totally to you, but in conformity with God's plan and design. Namely, we're not going to shut out God and his creative act. We're not going to shut out life, which is what this is for. And we're going to make it truly to be an act of love. An irreplaceable love. An I for you and you for I. See? So what happens is that in the act of marriage, in the 60s, up to 1965, you could not buy a contraceptive in this country. Did you know that? It's against the law. Marriage was sacred. It's interesting now, they've been trying to change marriage, same-sex marriage, in 30 states now it's been rejected. Only two states. It wasn't by the people, by a court, judge, Connecticut and Massachusetts. Wherever there has been a referendum, every state has rejected it. 30 states right now. Even California. Imagine that? You didn't think that's possible, did you? Now, so what happens is this, is that the context then is that in God's design, a woman is only able to fertilize on how many days in a cycle? How many days in a cycle could a woman conceive? Is that she's actually able, fertility-wise, to conceive? One day. Ovulation takes place one day in the cycle. That's it. Now, because if there's a special mucus present, if the seed of life from the man is present, it can stay alive, be potent, for a period of 72 hours. But if it's not present, that special mucus, it will not, within 1 hour, it's impotent. But the woman herself only ovulates one day in the cycle. And 24 hours, probably 12 hours, that's it. That's it. Now, what do we do today? Of course, we have these contraceptives, people pouring this junk into their bodies every day of the month. Useless. Because God so designed marriage that you only could conceive one day in a month, technically. And so that what happens is this, why does he do that? Because there's two aspects here. There is the love of I for you and you for I, and the sexual act is a special language of the body by which a man and a woman say to each other, I love you. And it strengthens their love. As long as it's an act of love. And that is most of the cycle. But there does come a moment in the cycle when conception could take place. And you cannot deliberately, at that moment in the cycle, exclude life and God. Because you're taking it out of context now. See? In other words, sex is beautiful because there's a mystery here. The visible and the invisible. Sex is beautiful because this is the means by which you came into existence. Sex is beautiful because it's they're being called by God to cooperate with God, the man and the woman, in bringing a person who is to exist forever in a loving relationship with the triune God and with their parents and with others. This is a magnificent, wonderful thing that is degraded. How is it degraded? It's degraded because in 65 we started with the contraceptives. Basically, what do the contraceptives do? It separates the act of love and sexuality from God and life. And it makes the end purpose of the sexuality pleasure. And the woman now becomes an object. The man is an object of self-gratification. And you're replaceable. There's no longer the mystery working with God. There's no mystery, the plan, the design. It's all shot. And so what was going to alleviate the problems of marriage has destroyed marriages. It was supposed to be only allowed for people who were married in the privacy of their home. That was the first decision, Eisenstadt versus Connecticut, 1965. In 1972, they said, well, maybe people aren't married but are adults. By late 70s, well, maybe those who aren't adults could do it. By the 80s, well, maybe we could introduce kids into public schools. By the 90s, without the parents' permission. On and on and on it goes. You grow up and you think it was natural, normal, like all the time. No, that is one of the greatest evils of the 20th century. It has destroyed marriage. It has produced infidelity among married couples. It has produced the young people saying, why should I wait? Wait for what? You say to me, there's a plan, there's a purpose, you wait, there's an act of love, and then you get married and you use contraceptives. What were you waiting for? You denied the whole thing. So we won't bother getting married. More people don't get married today. Everybody has relationships. They all have condoms and diaphragms and everything else. And it's destroying. Venereal disease is totally out of control today, as you well know. Out of control. They have given up in curing it. Do you know that? They've totally given up on it now. All they try to do is contain it, control it. Don't try to give it. It's too widespread. It's a disaster, absolute disaster. Plus, it destroys people. It destroys marriage. Now, so Paul VI, 1968, said, you must not separate or you will perish. Section 17 in Humani Vitae, read it, was prophetic of our times. He described the 21st century. He said, if you separate this act of love and sexuality and deny God's plan and don't see things in the light of the whole, you will perish. because women will be taken off the pedestal and treated as objects. What you do in your homes, the governments will do at a major level. It will destroy young people. Young people are growing with these urges and drives within them, and now you're going to make it easy, so to speak. No responsibility. Get out of it. No problems. You're going to destroy young people. You see? And he said, he went on, and he said, the governments will use this, and they'll force it upon you. Read section 17, 1968. Prophetic of what has happened, okay? So, a Holy Father said in 1968, you must not separate this act of sexuality. He said, look, God has provided that you can love, a man and a woman can love each other all through the month, because you can't conceive. But when it comes to that moment in the month when conception could take place, you cannot deliberately shut out God and life, because you now have become the creator, not the creature. You are changing your nature, not recognizing it for what it is, and acting in conformity to it. And you will perish, because when you go against nature, we self-destruct. Or they emphasize that in the environment. All the environmentalists emphasize that. But they refuse to see it in relationship to themselves as persons, and try to understand the environment of a woman, the environment of our own nature. We totally abuse it and think that we will not perish. We worry about the water, the air, forget about it. Don't be anybody around to appreciate the water, the air. We're all dying. It's a dying population, as you know. Population implosion all over the world. All over the world. No questions. So the Holy Father said, at your risk you do this. Now, in 1987, Daughter Beta, the gift of life. What happened? Pope Benedict XVI, then Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, he said, life from conception to birth is under attack. See, once you separate the act of love and sexuality from life, once you said there is no plan, no design, you cannot argue against homosexuality. You cannot argue against lesbianism. You cannot. You say, I don't like, you know, it's emotional, you feel that way, fine. But you cannot say it's wrong. On what basis can you say it's wrong? Once you made the end purpose of sex, pleasure. That's what we did with the contraceptives. Pleasure. You cannot argue against homosexuality. Once you say, no, there's a design and a plan that I must also conform to, married people must conform to, young people must conform to, there's a design and plan of God that with the power that God gives to us called the virtue of chastity, we're able to act according to our state of life, and we do it with God's grace and with reason, and this is what makes it a living, viable, healthy society. Once you remove all of that, you open the doors. Now what happened? When you separated the act of love and sexuality from life, and who enabled you to do that? Technology, science. We come in and we'll give you Depo-Provera, we'll give you tampons, we'll give you condoms, we'll give you birth control pills, we'll give you everything. We'll separate it, we'll take care of the results. That same crowd, by 1987, Pope Benedict said this. As Pope Paul said, you must not separate the act of love and sexuality from life. I now say to you and to the world, you must not separate life from the act of love and sexuality. Namely, God wants life to be conceived in the context of family, not in the laboratories, not grown in petri dishes. Now it's completely out of control. As you know, in England, they just passed the law through the parliament, overwhelming, in which they are deliberately growing life in the laboratories to use it to experimentation, which they are now going to subsidize, growing human life with animals, hybrids, experimentations. Right? They take human life and they grow parts, they do everything. The highest levels. Once you go down the path of no limitations, no wisdom, there's no end to this. Goes on and on and on and on. Okay? It's a problem. A real problem. See? So, the Holy Father said, we have reached the point where life from conception to natural birth is under attack because we have lost the sense of the whole. Namely, life should not be conceived in petri dishes in the laboratories. Human life was meant by God to be brought into existence out of an act of love in the context of marriage. And nowhere else. Nowhere else. You see, you're not only counterculture in regards to abortion. You're counterculture in regards to whole contraceptive sterilization. You're counterculture against all these fertility clinics, all this growing of life in the laboratories. You are truly counterculture. If you understand that. You understand that, see? Now, by 1995, John Paul II, he said, not only is life under threat in the process of procreation, not only is family under attack, not only is life misused and grown and abused from conception to birth, he said life now is under attack to death itself. Namely, most of that encyclical, it deals with euthanasia. Euthanasia. And as you know, I mentioned in the sermon this morning, in Washington, D.C., on Election Day, the people in Washington, the state of Washington, the referendum went through for euthanasia. It's only beginning. It's going to sweep across the country. I say to old people, don't go to a hospital unless you're very healthy. Because you're not coming out. And of course, the children will take care of that. Because every reason that you give now for an abortion, much more so will apply to get rid of mom and dad, grandma and grandpa. I don't want my child to suffer. Right? Nor do I want grandpa. I can't afford it. I can't afford grandpa's, you see. Everything we give for killing of the unborn children will be used for the killing of the elderly. And not only the elderly, but anyone who is disabled, with disabilities. You do know now, you see that little kid that was holding the sign today? Oh, isn't she, she's priceless, I love that girl, okay? She's Down syndrome. Those Down syndrome children give nothing but love. They're back, magnificent. Okay? That's what I think of Sarah Palin. I have to say that Sarah Palin was wonderful, the example. She had that Down syndrome child that she had, you know? And she was allowing her child, her daughter to give back. Wonderful, what a wonderful pro-lifer. Yes, she really was. And that's why she was attacked. That's why she was destroyed. No questions asked. No questions asked, okay? But that kid, the Down syndrome child, open up your eyes and look around and see how many younger ones than her you find today. In our country alone, now 90% of the Down syndrome children are now killed. In Europe, it's 95% now. Why? Because Professor Jérôme Lejeune, the great scholar from the Sorbonne University, was a friend of mine. I had dinner with him shortly before he died. He's the one who found, he's the father of genetics. And he found the cause of Down syndrome. And after he found the cause of Down syndrome, he said to me, Father, he said, I rejoiced. And I thought my fellow scientists would rejoice with me. They did. And I thought they'd give me money. Now we could look for the cure since we know the cause. They laughed at me. They laughed at me. They said, Professor Lejeune, you've done a great service. But the service you've done, of course, you understand, is now we know the cause, now we can get rid of them all. It's called, see, you have genetics, which is trying to study the genes that affect us and trying to cure things. It's wonderful, good science. But you have eugenics. Eugenics is totally different. Eugenics is to search out and destroy anyone who's not genetically perfect. And they decide who should breed, that's positive eugenics, and who should not breed, that's negative eugenics. And the ones involved in negative eugenics is Planned Parenthood from the very beginning. What was the original name of Planned Parenthood? Original name of Planned Parenthood. Birth control. Controlling those who should conceive and controlling those who should not conceive. Get rid of them. They had the same mentality. They were friends. Margaret Sanger was a friend and knew Adolf Hitler. They're both companies, and a lot of people in this country agreed with them, and still do. We might have lost, we might have won the battle, the war. We lost the war of ideas. That master race is here, right now, worldwide. It's called. Do you know if when you go to these fertility clinics, and they want to get into fertility clinics, they want everything to be in the fertility clinics, because then they can determine who will live and who will die. See, right now they feel abortions are haphazard. A lot of kids who are very healthy are being killed. That kills them. Kids who are not healthy are being allowed to be born. If we had, as scientists, control, like turning out a car, we see the car is damaged, get it off. It's got to be perfect. So in the laboratories today, I don't know if you know this, in England it's the law. Since 1991 in the United States, it's the practice. No child conceived on a petri dish is allowed to be implanted in the womb of a mother unless the child passes the test. What test, Father? The pre-implantation genetic diagnostic test. If it fails the test, it's killed. If it fails the test, it's killed. In other words, they have the child on the petri dish. They, with their microscopes, they look at the genetic makeup. If the genetic makeup is acceptable, to whom? In other words, if they're biologically perfect, then they can continue to exist. If the quality of your life biologically is not acceptable to others, you're eliminated. You will not, there is no life, that's the practice in the United States, it's the law in England, no life in these fertility clinics that's found in the petri dish, if it fails the pre-implantation genetic diagnostic test, is implanted. See, in other words, where is a child conceived? Where does this conception take place? In the fallopian tubes. In other words, you have the uterus, and from the uterus there's two arms that go out, tubes, and on either side of that coming is the ovary. So the ovary releases an ovum, it comes into the fallopian tube, and it's in the tube that the sperm meets the ovum, and fertilization takes place. And after it takes place there, it starts to multiply into a blastocyst, into an embryo, and it makes its way down through the fallopian tube into the uterus, and then implants. Now, it cannot implant on the wall of the uterus unless there's rich blood cells there. So while the ovary is producing the ovum, it sends into the bloodstream a hormone that starts to cause inside the uterus a development of rich blood cells. Now, when the new life comes down, if the rich blood cells are there, it survives, it's fed, it's able to implant. If they're not there, it'll starve to death, will not be able to implant, and it'll be passed. Now, in 1960, the original pill, suppressed ovulation, like 96% of the time. But it had 42 side effects on a woman's body. And by 1969, there were public hearings in Washington, D.C., from the women in this country screaming, "You didn't tell us. You didn't tell us about all these wretched side effects that are dangerous to our very physical existence." Now, when they were experimenting and developing the pill, where did they do that? On the poor woman in Puerto Rico. Through the 50s. By 1960, they had got to a point that it was suppressing enough that they wanted to put it on the market. But they couldn't put it on the market because it was against the law to sell contraceptives. So they made it into a health thing. It was to control menstrual aberrations. And all of a sudden, we had 1 million women in America with menstrual problems. Now, what happened was this. By 1969, the American women were getting strokes, blood clots, all types of things. Because if you suppress nature, common sense, it's going to have an effect somewhere else. Whenever they put the knife to you to an operation, you'll find out how it affects the rest eventually. Don't fool around with nature. Awful avenger. So by 1969, there were public hearings, and they were suing the pharmaceutical companies. So the pharmaceutical companies went back into their labs and changed the makeup of the pill. What'd they do? They said, it's too harmful. Let us develop a pill with a double mechanism. It will only suppress ovulation 50% of the time, but the other 50% of the time, the life will not be conceived because it will remove the rich blood cells on the lining of the uterus, that if life is conceived, even when it gets down to the womb, it will be starved to death, it will not be able to implant. Maybe it's an abortifacient. It doesn't stop conception, it stops the life after it has been conceived. Since 1970. The so-called morning after pill, guess what that is? In which you take more than one. It's the original pill that was removed from the markets because it's so harmful. And now we have college kids across the campuses, over the counter, popping these pills, which were removed in 1970 because they were so physically harmful to women. And here these kids are taken every weekend. What is going to be the long-run effect on that? You don't have to be a genius to figure it out, but they don't give a damn. It's called population control. It's called don't stop anything from sexuality being practiced. The purpose of sex is pleasure. Anything gets in the way of pleasure, like human life, restrictions, eliminate them. The young people are being exploited into the ground. Ignorance. I'm sorry, but many priests don't know a thing in this whole area. Harmful. When's the last time you heard us talk on contraceptives? Don't hold your breath. I'm sorry, we should be proclaiming it clearly, making it understood and known. It's the truth. It's the best thing. Okay? Now, so what happened is this, they took the this pill and they changed the makeup and said, abortifacient. 80% of the so-called contraceptives on the market today are not contraceptives. They're abortifacients. They work the same way. They destroy the life after it is conceived in the fallopian tube. Now, what's the difference between the morning after pill and the RU486? That is simple. If the child comes down and implants on the wall of the uterus, the morning after pill is useless. Too late. It's got to kill the child before it implants. After it implants, you use the RU486 because it can kill the child to the 12th or 13th week. But the morning after pill is in a abortifacient. Now, what they say to the young people is this: if you had relations last night, within 72 hours, make sure that you get the morning after pill. And they say, we will test to see if you're pregnant. We'll only give you the pill if the test comes back that you're not pregnant. This is doublespeak. Doublespeak. Why? Let me tell you something. No test you give, except a very, very expensive genetic test. No test in the first week can tell whether you're pregnant or not. Because the way you find out you're pregnant is simple. The child is conceived in the fallopian tube, starts to develop, comes down into the womb, and implants itself on the wall of the uterus, and the child sends into the mother's bloodstreams hormones and chemicals that lets them know, I'm here. And the blood test picks it up. But you can't pick it up until the kid does that. And if you take a blood test and you pick it up, you say, it's too late, it's implanted. Morning after pill will be useless. So we give the test and we say, you're not pregnant, we're going to give the morning after pill. Why are you giving the morning after pill if you're not pregnant? Precisely because you could be pregnant. Because we don't know, in other words, if you had relations today, you may be pregnant or immediately. But it's not going to show up until 5-7 days later. So, but you still can be pregnant because the child, we don't know that. The child knows and God knows that. It's coming down. You see? And the thing is that if you are pregnant, the morning after pill will get it. Because it will remove the lining of the uterus that the child will not be able to implant. It'll starve to death. But if it already has implanted, we know it has implanted because the pregnancy test says you're pregnant, then we can't use the morning after pill. We have to use the RU486. or a surgical abortion. You follow this? It's all evil. Profound evil. Making fools. And even priests and they got the whole thing so fouled up and stupid, it just drives me crazy at this point. At this point. This is 40 years after Humanitate. What are we waiting for? God help us. Anyway, so what happens is this, is that the church, you have to understand, Paul the Benedict the 16th, Cardinal Ratzinger, said that life starts at conception. We all know that. Do you know what they did in 1970, 1980? They changed the definition of pregnancy. Look at the earlier textbooks. You'll see pregnancy, everybody knows it. There was a famous article in 1965 in Life magazine, pictures of the life before birth, and which it starts with, everybody knows the scientific fact that life begins at conception. Pregnancy begins at conception. Of course it does. It begins at the beginning. You know, it's a Yogi Berra statement, you know? Anyways, you're trying to tell me life begins after it has begun, and it's over before it ends. They're telling me that, why? Because you want to experiment on the life, you want to use your contraceptives, which actually now are abortifacients, by telling me it isn't a pregnancy until it plants on the walls of the uterus. Now we have a confirmed pregnancy. That's the word they use this pulpit, confirmed pregnancy. It is life, and it begins at conception. But if you want to experiment on that life, you want to do all your things in the laboratories, you want to have all your contraceptives, then we have to change the definition of when pregnancy begins. So we say pregnancy begins at implantation. Total lie. But if you read the small print, what does it say? An affirmed pregnancy begins at implantation. Affirmed. Because now we know for sure. But it could have begun, but they know damn well, 7 days before. You understand? This is important to understand this. So what has happened is this, is that we have this whole double talk, double speak, in which they are growing life, experimenting in life, and trying to make you believe it's not life until we tell you it is. And of course the other end of the spectrum is they're trying to say that you're dead before you're dead. They use words like a vegetative state. A human being is never a vegetable. A human being is a human being genetically, biologically, from the very beginning, or it never will be a human being. You don't go from stages being a fish, a mammal, and so forth, a human being. That's nonsense. With modern molecular biology, genetics, that's pure nonsense. You either are human genetically from the day one, conception, or you never will be a human being. That's the reality of it. But they want to convince you that, in some strange way, that you, not only is the child not human until we finish our testing in the beginning, but it's not human at the end, so you might as well put it out of its vegetative state, useless state, at the end, called euthanasia. They're both sides. What happened in 73? What happened in 73 is this. There was a philosophical struggle, and we lost. We lost. What was it? Before 73, we believed in Western civilization that life was sacred because it's a gift of God. The state did not give you the gift of life. Your parents didn't give you the gift of life. Life came from God, and God gives life, and God takes life. No one else. And every life has an absolute value, the sanctity of life. People differ qualitatively. One's small, one's big, one sings, one's thin, one's a good athlete, so forth. Everybody has their own gifts. But you don't determine a person's right to life on the quality of their life. A person's right to life comes from God. And the quality differs. We should try to give everybody a good quality of life to the extent that we can. That was Western civilization. Suddenly, in the decision of Roe v. Wade, that was turned upside down. Namely, that the quality of life became the absolute value. And your right to life depended upon the quality of your life as determined by others. So even in the womb, with that decision, we changed the right to life three times over. We said first trimester, second trimester, third trimester, after birth. What are you talking about? In other words, your right to life keeps changing according to the quality of your life as determined by others. That was a total, complete change of Western civilization. Western civilization is life is sacred. Everyone's life is sacred. No exceptions. Born or unborn. Senile, sound. Down syndrome, anyone. The quality of life differs for each one. We ought to try to help everybody to have at least a minimum quality of life. That's one. That's gone. Gone. We have this elitist group who is determining who will live and who will die. They give amniocentesis tests, they give all these tests, genetic tests, all these tests before, and they recommend to the parents, oh, don't have this child. Why? Well, they have Down syndrome. We'll have this, we'll have that. What the hell are you talking about? And of course, the other end is get rid of grandma because, well, they're just suffering. Their life is meaningless. Meaningless. It's the most precious time of your life. The most precious time of the life of Jesus was on the cross suffering. He was redeeming the world. He was giving glory to God. He was making up a reparation for the sins. He was gaining graces. And so that happens with a person who is sick and elderly. It's incredible, rich time of one's life. And you want to cut it short. You want to play God. You want to eliminate them. You want to treat them like they're not human anymore. Why? Because we're selfish. Selfish. We don't want grandma eating up the money that could use my kids. I don't want grandma I have to keep going to visit. I even dumped them all in the nursing homes. I don't keep them at home anymore. Very interesting society we have, right? And on the other side, I don't want to be bothered with this kid who's going to be disabled, Down syndrome, and so forth. I can't be bothered with that. I don't want to make the kid suffer. A child, no one dies because of their suffering. They always die because others don't want to suffer or be inconvenienced or sacrifice. That's why they die. Right? Not because a child doesn't want this. I'm so merciful. I won't have my child suffer. Oh, stop it. Stop it. What you're talking about is yourself. Yourself, you see? Don't kid me. But the part is this, when they do that, they regret it for the rest of their lives. This is when they're killing grandma now. That's not going to walk away from that. They're going to know. They're going to know, just like when they kill the kid. Same thing. There'll be unbelievable repercussions. Plus, it becomes frightening. It becomes frightening for people in such a society. Okay? So what happened is this, That became the gamut. That became the gamut. And the population control people, they do not believe in God. Many of them do not. They don't see a spiritual soul. They don't see a human being in the laboratories. They see in the evolutionary process that the work of evolution goes forward when the survival of the fittest. Constant change, mutations, in which the weak are eliminated and the strong survive, and progress is made. Isn't that evolution? So we say. So we're going to use our brains to help the evolutionary process to go forward in an intelligent fashion. And we'll test and pick out all the imperfect and eliminate them. So the human race will go forward with perfection. They never pick themselves out, by the way. It's always others. Others. And so, as I say now, this evolutionary process, they think they're doing a service. They think they're helping to bring about a great new creation, a new age, by helping this evolutionary process to go forth in a more intelligent fashion, in which they are eliminating the weak and the handicapped and the sick, and making sure the strong survive and will create this new beautiful race. Now what happens, of course, is the people themselves in the very beginning say, well, I think I'll order this. When you go and talk about designer jeans, you're not talking about clothing anymore. You're talking about people going into these laboratories, okay, into the laboratories, and deciding, this is what I want. Blue eyes, I want a healthy boy, I want this, I want that, and let me see the... And so they have sperm banks. They have ovum banks. But the stupid need not apply. The minority is very funny. They're headed over here in New York City with no minorities in that bank. And you had to have a pedigree. You went to Columbia University, you went to Harvard. What is your background? What is it? And we're going through the book to see which genes we'll pick. We'll pick. And then they measure. They measure. And what happens is this. Then you have, think about this now. Think about this, how far we have come. For at what point does a young girl, child, whatever, have all the ova in the ovaries that they will have for all of their adult life, childbearing years? At what age? 8 weeks gestation. 8 weeks gestation. At 8 weeks, the child is totally formed. Only growth takes place after 8 weeks. Biological fact. Mom's ovum is not working. We need to get an ovum. Well, you can get it from, I saw it advertised just recently in the paper. The young woman has said, if you donate your ovum and it's used to complete the cycle, you will get $8,000. You can pay your way through college, make the couple happy, etc., etc., etc. William, there's a Methodist hospital right over here. It's all over. It's all over, see? Now, suppose we can't get the ovums. Well, there is a source of this, you know. If at 8 weeks the child has the ovums, the great source could be aborted babies, little girls. And they were doing that. They were getting the ova from the aborted children in England, shipping them to the fertility clinics here in the United States. Now, the sperm might have come from some quick fella up there at Harvard University, who doesn't even care, he got his money, he's on the run. So the sperm could come from a student in Harvard. The ovum could come from an aborted child. And the mother, now this is meshed on a petri dish and implanted in her, who now is a surrogate mother. And the father, he's a nothing. You imagine this? Right? And we call this progress. We call this progress. See how this thing goes? Once you say there's no order, no plan, no design, whatever we want to do, science keeps insisting, whatever we can do, we should be allowed to do. Sorry, you give us a barbaric society. You also are limited by reality. And science must be reined in with Judaic Christian ethics. They are not able and allowed to do whatever they want to do. That's how we get the atom bombs. We have a different atom bomb in the biological bombs of human beings at the present time. Now you come along, and you come along with an awareness of a design, a whole, a vision, and you have to weigh what's happening in front of you and not be just swept away. You must stand firm against the current. You see, you only can go upstream if you're alive. Everything that's dead goes downstream. You've got to be a live swimmer for life, going against the current. But you know, you're the only ones who are going to save society, because the other is a dead end road. When you don't follow, when you don't follow the wisdom of God, the plan and wisdom, and you act accordingly, ultimately you perish. The society, the individuals, and there's no happiness. So you don't have to feel that we're imposing. No, you're saving. You don't have to feel that we're making these other people. No, you're not forcing. You are like a good physician, insisting the person take the proper medicine and food. Otherwise, they will perish. They can do what they want. They're self-destructing. You see those people out there today screaming and yelling? Don't ask me about their lifestyle. I have a suspicion. They're not happy. They are not happy campers. Okay? They're confused. They're part of the result of this. Okay? You have to sit down one by one and try to break it down and restore them to sanity. Thanks be to God, you know you're standing there, and by the grace of God, you're standing in wisdom. You're standing there in peace. You say that without a lot of the problems those people have already. They are the part of the crop that this society is growing. I don't blame them. It's the reason I work with them. I try to bless them. You see, try to change them. Okay, but I will not accept it. The difference? I will not accept it. Okay. Okay. What I'm going to do is I'm going to give you out the sheet. We'll go over it later. I wrote this up one night. I did. Okay? It'll take you a while to read it. For the diocese, I want natural family planning to be part of the training for any couples studying for marriage in our diocese. And I saw a long voice, but I wanted it. Someone invited me to the meeting. I guess after they figured, how did he get in here? and what they I wanted to do was to give an explanation. And they said, well, it'll take too long to do. We can't. We've got to have it all in tomorrow. I said, I'll do it tonight. Right? I got it into the thing for tomorrow. Right? So I spent the night writing this up. Okay? So I'm going to give it to you, and we're going to go through it later. But you could take it now in the light of what we've been speaking. Okay, let's speak. In other words, I called it, a woman should marry a man for all seasons. Okay. And I have here, the menstrual cycle of a woman has been described as similar to the seasons of the year. In each cycle, the inner environment of the woman's body goes through changes like the changes that occur in the external environment of nature. In autumn, trees shed their rich foliage and prepare for new life or growth. The sign of autumn time in the woman is the shedding of the inner lining of the uterus, while the ovum grows and matures within the ovary. The autumn season is menstruation. As in nature, so in the woman, autumn is followed by winter. In winter, the temperature drops and the earth appears dry and barren, even though a hidden growth is occurring. The mystery of life through apparent death permeates all of creation, and it is found also in a woman's body. The signs of the winter season for the woman is a drop in her basal body temperature, accompanied by a sensation of vaginal dryness while the ovum is imperceptibly maturing. The time needed for the ovum to mature and break forth determines the length of winter and makes a cycle long or short. Winter gives way to spring when the ovum bursts forth from the ovary as flowers burst forth in the season of spring. The sign of spring in the woman is the opening of the cervix and a special cervical mucus. Finally, spring yields to the sustained high temperatures of summer, and again a vaginal dryness appears. If conception takes place, the season of summer will continue with the temperatures remaining high and the maintenance of the inner walls of the uterus in order to provide for the new human life a warm, healthy environment. If there is no conception, summer will yield in 14 to 16 days to the cooler temperatures of autumn, and the inner lining of the uterus will be shed. Then a new menstrual cycle will begin. As a young woman increases her awareness through natural family planning of the various seasons found in each menstrual cycle, as so also in the same woman there will be an increased wonderment and respect for the God-given life potential process in her body, and a greater sense of personal dignity and appreciation of her potentiality motherly role. The young woman should marry a man for all seasons, namely, one who will respect the inner environment and accept all the seasons of his wife's feminine cycle, especially the springtime of life. Okay.
Sometimes on Saturdays when we're counseling, there's a lot of women going in for contraception.
Yes.
What do you think would be a better argument, or not argument, but what do you think would be more persuasive? Talking about contraception, how it separates the procreative and the unitive aspects, or do you think we should tell women about abortifacient? If we only had a quick bit to tell them about contraception, what do you think is
right? Right. Okay, that is what we're trying to do is to try to put a little one page thing material together to insert it for them. today they're very conscious of environment, respect the environment, and yet respect the environment of the woman. We just forget that totally. You see, there is the two things. You see, the one thing is that it is. Destructive to her own health, that's a fact, and to the idea that they don't know that for 80% of the time it's an abortifacient, you see? But you could mention that, you know, in other words, that this doesn't stop 80% of the time conception, that the new life that's conceived will just destroy it, you see? And it's not good for your health, and it's the wrong answer. Okay? That's basically, that's what, 30 seconds. Okay? If you take a look at this, I'm going to read it through. I had the first page. Okay, we read it. And we're going to continue here, okay? Everybody have the copy now? Okay. Okay. Yeah. Okay. It says, sex being God's creation is holy and good. Now, all of what I said is a preface to this. Okay? Namely, to understand your sexuality, to understand an act, an individual act of sex, you have to take it in the context of the whole. See, we use slices to make the moral judgment. In other words, to say, well, I have to use contraceptives, I have to have the abortion because I'm not healthy. It doesn't say what's right or wrong. It just says you're not healthy. It doesn't say this act is right or wrong. Right? Or I can't afford it. Now it's the financial. Now it's the health. Or there's too many people. Now it's the population thing. See? Or it's not, I'm too young, too old. See, it's not the right time. In other words, we're making a moral judgment on a slice, just a piece, not a whole, no wisdom. Right? That's when you get wrong moral judgments. You have to step back and ask, is this right or wrong? Never mind on the basis of health, finances, and so forth. And we make that judgment constantly for abortion and contraceptives. Okay? And we destruct. I'm going to try to give you here the whole picture, and it's in the context of the whole picture that you make the judgment, is the use of contraceptives right or wrong? You follow? Okay. Okay. With the bottom of that first page. It says, God, sex being God's creation is holy and good. That's a very important thing I've got to stress to you. What happens is this, young people are told, you can't do this, you can't do that, and you can't because you're not married, the whole context, see? But you can start to think that sex is wrong, that sex, if God made something wrong here. And even after they get married, they may feel, this is not right. No, it wasn't right before you got married, but now that you're married, it's perfectly okay, you see? But that happens, okay? We'll try to eliminate that. We'll try to give the whole picture, okay? Since God created us male and female, we didn't make ourselves, that's what you find. So, of course God has made us male and female, He created marriage. Okay, the society, the family. Since God created us male and female in the image of God, sexuality in a man and a woman is the result of God's design, God's creation. In other words, the only society that is definitely, we cannot change, that God created, is the family. God made us social beings. What does that mean? We need one another. How we relate with each other, that differs. It could be a socialism. It could be an oligarchy, it could be a monarchy, it could be a democracy. There's no set thing. Okay, that's it. But the society that you have can change, but you cannot change the society of the family. That's God's creation. That's what we're doing now. And in the society of the family, no matter what type of government you choose, the building block that they must all be built upon is family. And when you destroy family, no society will sustain and will last. What we're doing today is we're destroying family, the whole concept of family. And that we destruct the democracy, call whatever you want, it's going down the tubes. I don't care what form of government you choose, it will not last because there's no foundation. The foundation of society is the society that God made, and we cannot change family. Family. Follow that? Okay? So it says here, since God created us male and female in the image of God, sexuality in a man and a woman is the result of God's design, God's creation. We are told in Genesis that when God looked upon His creation, God saw that it was good and holy. As a matter of fact, Yahweh frequently expressed His love for Israel using sexual terminology, as indeed did Christ for His bride, the church. Whenever any culture seriously distorts or entirely misinterprets the true meaning of human sexuality because it separates it from its essential reference to the person, the church will always insist on sex as God's creation and as being properly understood only in the context of personal love and the transmission of life. Okay? Now, understanding creation and its proper use. To understand the Church's position on human sexuality requires some clear thinking on our part. For example, when you or I make or create anything, be it a stove, a painting, a house, the end or purpose that we have in mind determines what we make or its nature. Obviously, a stove is for cooking, a painting for seeing, a house for living in. You would rightly have serious reservations about marrying a person who would try to eat the painting, stand outside looking at the house, and put his head in the stove. And if you didn't have reservations there, you got a problem. Okay? No. But we do that. That's exactly what we do. See, by studying its nature, or what something is, we learn how to properly use it. Only then is the ultimate goal and or purpose of which it was made achieved. The person standing freezing outside the house with his stomach violently reacting from the painting and his head burnt from the hot stove might be filled with all types of good intentions. But intentions without first being using your head, your intellect, can be useless if not destructive. That's very important to understand that. Okay? There is an order. There is an order. Now, God created this world and you and me for a purpose. In order that this purpose be achieved, God wants us to use our heads before using His creation. God is not asking us to change what He has made. That is to change our nature, which would mean to change the purpose for which God made us. We have no right to alter or manipulate God's creation, since we are the creature. God is the creator. He is the potter. We are the clay. Rather, God wants us with our intellect to reflect on what we are in order to become all that God intends us to be. Freedom separated from reason results in all types of absurdities, like a man putting his head in a hot stove. Sure, he can do this, but may he? Reason gives light and direction to the will and freedom. The truth shall make us free, free to reach
pure
perfection. To separate our actions from what a thing is or what we are frustrates or prevents the end or purpose of being achieved. And so before discussing the rightness and wrongness of any individual action or the proper use of the sexual organs, we must rightly ask the more general question, what is man? The right answer is crucial, for it will provide true wisdom and direction to our will and our freedom. In Christian tradition, man has been variously defined as a created composite of body and soul, an embodied spirit, a rational animal, a bodily creature with an intellect and a free will. Since man is a substantial union of body and spirit, it naturally follows that to have a truly human act, the spirit and the body must function together. A person should mean what he says and say what he means. Otherwise, falsehood or confusion will result. Sexual intercourse by a man and a woman must always be the expression of their spirit, an act of love, not just the body. The unitive meaning must not be absent. Namely, they should mean what they say. Human sexuality is qualitatively different from animal sexuality that does not involve an intelligent, free, loving act. On the other hand, in the act of intercourse, the sexual organs should be used in the proper way. The couple should say what they mean. How does one properly use the sexual organs? Obviously, by acting in conformity with their purpose or finality as determined by the Creator. How do we find that out? We learn it by studying their design or their nature. In this sense, human sexuality must be learned by the intellect and controlled by the will. We may only aid nature, we must not change nature. Only God can do that. The scientific basis of natural family planning. Each engaged couple can discover the purpose of the sexual organs by carefully studying and understanding the scientific basis of the menstrual or feminine cycle. This knowledge will also increase the couple's confidence and appreciation of natural family planning. To gain this knowledge is a bit of a challenge, but well worth the effort. The menstrual cycle is a repeated, dynamic process that takes place in the ovaries and uterus of most women between the ages of 13 to 45 or 50. Its ultimate purpose is the transmission of life, namely pregnancy and the birth of a child. To achieve this goal, the first half of the cycle is oriented towards liberating an ovum from the ovary, called ovulation, and the reception, protection of the male seed or sperm, and then finally facilitating a meeting of the male seed with the ovum in the fallopian tube, called fertilization. The second half of the feminine cycle is oriented to the child's reception and protection by preparing that proper maternal environment in the uterus for the tiny embryo that will arrive there in 5 or 6 days after conception. After the embryo's arrival, or called implantation, the child will send a chemical message into the mother's blood, ordering the corpus luteum to continue its work. This half of the cycle will end 9 months later in birth. On the other hand, if fertility fails in the first half of the cycle, no chemical message will be sent to the mother by an embryo, and after 14 to 16 days, the second half of the cycle will end with the shedding of the prepared endometrium, or inner lining of the uterus. This results in a discharge of blood called the menstrual period, or menses, from the word month. One then might say that there are three objectives in the feminine cycle. The first objective of the menstrual cycle is to allow an ovary to release an ovum. How does this happen? A few days after menstruation, the ovary receives a double order from an area in the brain, the hypothalamus, through a hormone secreted by the pituitary gland located at the base of the brain. What is the order? The ovary is told to mature a follicle, or cavity, and its contents, an ovum. And secondly, to develop and manufacture a hormone, a chemical substance, that is carried by blood to the other parts of the body, called estrogen. Estrogen not only causes the development of the secondary sex characteristics that remotely prepare a young woman to be a mother, development of the uterus as a first home for the child, broadened pelvis to facilitate the birth of a child, but the growth of the breast for feeding of the child after birth. I often say to young women, I said, what does the word mama mean? Mama. It's the Latin word breast. Mama. Mama, you go, if you want to check if you had cancer or something, get a mammography. Okay? And a reading of the breast. In other words, we, our modern society, do not allow the woman to understand that and the young fellas properly to understand that the breast is the means by which the mother provides the best possible food, nurture. We now know the breastfeeding is the best food in all the world for the child. They actually now are almost ordering it, encouraging it, you see? And it's a natural development for this whole thing connected with life. What we do now is we try to make the women stop halfway through the cycle, so to speak, and think of themselves as objects, okay? Depersonalized, sex objects, gratification, right? In which they become these strange. You see, the reality is it's the breast, the size of the breast doesn't determine whether a mother is able to feed. No matter how, the size is just the fat, whatever it may be, but the mother is able to feed a child no matter how, what is the size of the breast, and the more she feeds, the more the body produces the milk, you see? And most of the people throughout the world, they don't have stores to go down to, they don't have formulas, okay? They feed and nurture their children, and they're healthy because it's the best food in all the world, okay, that they have. But we have taken that whole, You see, it's part of, this part of pornography. Pornography depersonalizes sex. It makes people caught up with. Remember, I told you what contraceptives do. It makes the end purpose of sex to be pleasure. And when you follow that through, then it becomes homosexuality. When you follow that through, it becomes pornography. When you follow that through, then the wife becomes an object of pleasure, not a person who is loved. You see? And young women themselves begin to see themselves as sex objects. No, you're not. You are a person created by God with life-giving powers that are magnificent. Okay? And a person must, a fellow must respect the whole person, the wonder of a woman's body. It's miraculous. It's a miracle. You see? It's beautiful. Right? And I think sometimes the woman pregnant is the most beautiful woman. We forget that, but it's simple, that's the purpose, you see? It's beautiful. Beautiful, you see? And when they worry about the form, I've got to get rid of the kid because I want to keep looking beautiful. The object of, they're nuts. Right? But that's our society. That's the society, see? They fall into that. No, sir. It's the moment to give life, you're never more beautiful in the eyes of God, in society, in yourself, you see? It's a beautiful thing. Okay, just a minute. It's a side effect. Okay, right down there. Okay, but in each cycle, the estrogen begins the proximate preparation of the inner lining of the uterus for a possible implantation of a child. As the estrogen reaches its peak, the follicles in the ovary explodes the ovum. The projected mature ovum is then taken into the fallopian tube. The ovum survives at most 24 hours. For a future possible child, the ovum contains the maternal inherited traits. The other half comes from the sperm, or the male seed. This brings us to the second objective of the menstrual cycle. The second objective is to facilitate a meeting of the sperm and the ovum in the fallopian tube. When the sperm and the ovum meet, a new human life begins, fertilization. For the sperm deposited in the vagina during intercourse to ascend and to reach the ovum in the fallopian tube, the way must be open and a special favorable cervical mucus must be present. What causes this condition? About a week before ovulation, under the influence of the increasingly secreted estrogen, a way is opened when the neck of the womb or uterus, the cervix, is raised, softened, and opened to allow the easy passage of the sperm. Moreover, the increased estrogen causes the crypts in the cervix to secrete a favorable cervical mucus that, as the days go by, grows similar in appearance to raw egg white and becomes stretchy and slippery. In this most favorable mucus, the sperm can fertilize up to 72 hours. If it's not present within an hour, the sperm loses its potency. With the help of the mucus, the sperm is stored, maintained, or protected, and finally guided or transported to the ovum. So this estrogen causes the opening of the uterus, we call the cervix, to open and to change in texture to be able to take the sperm in. But if it doesn't also produce in the opening of the cervix this special mucus, it's like during most of the cycle it's dry, but then as ovulation comes about, it becomes present. But if it's stretchy and breaks, it's not ovulation yet. It's when it stretches like raw egg white, then you know ovulation has taken place, is about to take place. You see, and if that's not present, that special mucus, you will not conceive. Sometimes a woman can't conceive; she thinks she's got problems. She doesn't. A problem is the mucus, and if the mucus is corrected, as a matter of fact, they have like these fertility clinics. The rate of success may be 20%. They have, like Dr. Hilger's out in Creighton University, out in the West. He works with women studying what is the pathological condition stopping them from being able to conceive, like the lack of the mucus and so forth. He has a 65% success rate. 65%. The fertility clinic says 20%. Imagine that? Yeah? But they don't want you to know that because the fertility clinics charge a fortune, like $25,000. It's a fortune being made, among other things. Plus, they take the life, and they grow them, and they save them, and they use some experimentation. All types of evils coming out of that thing. Okay. Now, the second, an ovulation, as ovulation approaches, the cervix moves to a higher position, and the mouth of the cervix, the os, becomes softer, opens up, and is very slippery with mucus. By observing these signs, a woman can be aware of her fertility and the nearness of ovulation. The careful daily charting of these signs of fertility takes only a few minutes a day. That's a reality. Once you teach the woman, it's simple. A couple of minutes a day, and they can tell you where they are in the cycle, if they can be pregnant or not, and they just throw all the contraceptives out the window. And it's very healthy, too. It's very healthy, too. Plus, the man, he does the charting. The woman tells him. And now it becomes his responsibility. He grows up. It's not a woman's problem, you see, sexuality. It's a gift from God to the man and the woman who together know. If he wants to have relations, it's fine. Check the drawers, fella. The chart is right there. You drew up the chart. Are we ready for a child? Fine, we'll have it. If not, we'll wait a week. Okay? That's what they... But you see, what happens is this. When you wait the week, actually what's good about that, it's like honeymoon and courtship every cycle. Okay? Anyway, when you're waiting, that's the courtship. And then it's the honeymoon every cycle. When you just take it for granted, it's like so many glasses of beer on the wall. You're just an object's meaningless. No mystery, no nothing. Okay? Whereas always the mystery, will this be the time? Will this one when God will grant us a new life? You see? And this the whole, and you're treating each other with respect. You're both taking your sexuality and maturely using it where it truly is an act of love, conformity with God and His design. And the person never becomes simply an object of gratification. A person is loved. Plus, when you're not able to do it, you're faithful. If you never stop because you use contraceptives, then when you are on a trip, when you're at war, when you're other places, neither one's going to be faithful to the other. Okay? And infidelity, breakup of marriages, divorce, everything. And that's not the way it is. In life, there's times, you know, when people get sick, business calls them away, a lot of things. You have to be able to take all the cycles, you see? Okay. Is that page 5? Did we finish that? Mm-hmm. Did we finish page 5 here? Okay, next page. Page 6. Page 6. We got 4 minutes. We got 4 minutes, okay? So page 6. Did we finish page 5?
No.
Oh, God. This old man got prayed for me, okay? where'd I go to now? Is it top of the page? Top of page 5?
Yeah.
I'm so used, I thought I said it. Okay. Finally, the third objective of the menstrual cycle is to enable the implantation of an anticipated child in the mother's womb or uterus. What is involved here? Well, after the ovum leaves the follicle in the ovary, a small temporary gland called the corpus luteum, meaning a yellow body, develops in its place. The corpus luteum pours into the blood another female sexual hormone called progesterone. Progesterone has 4 important effects. First, it continues and intensifies the transformation of the inner lining of the uterus, the endometrium, so that it becomes soft, spongy, rich, with an increase of blood supply. Secondly, the progesterone causes a lowering and a firmness in the cervix itself, with the mucus turning into a gelatinous plug at the cervix opening. Keeps out all bacteria, shuts everything out, okay? Thirdly, it sends a signal to the brain to stop all orders to the pituitary gland. Thus, stimulation of the ovary stops and ovulation is suppressed. Lastly, it provides a warmer environment for the future embryo's development, thus raising 0.4 of a degree centigrade the woman's basal body temperature. So they have these thermometers, which you can check if the mother's temperature went up. Okay, so that indicates ovulation is taking place. You see, and it's sustained up, then you know that it has. Okay, that's nothing. When a new member or life arrives in the womb, it will send a chemical message for the progesterone to continue its work. If no message is received by the corpus luteum within 14 to 16 days after ovulation, then the progesterone will discontinue its work. Thus, the endometrium, being no longer nourished, will be shed, called menstruation, the bleeding, the monthly bleeding. That's very healthy. A woman, young girl, no one tells her nothing. She faces her first monthly bleeding. I mean, she's a very healthy young girl. She's capable of physically, you see, having life. maybe not yet spiritually, emotionally, and so forth, see, but physically she is. Then she, whereas they don't tell her, she thinks she's sick, it's dirty, whatever it may be. It's crazy, crazy. They should be informed intelligently, okay? The cervical Jonas plug will become a liquid, allowing the menstrual bleeding to flow through the open cervix. The temperature will drop to its previous low levels, and the brain, the hypothalamus, will once more stimulate the pituitary gland, and through the pituitary hormone, the ovary. Thus, a woman can be aware that she is in the infertile phase of her menstrual cycle by observing the scientifically based signs of infertility, namely, the rise in her basal body temperature, the low position of the cervix, with the os being firm, closed, and dry. By attending a natural family planning seminar, a couple can quickly learn how to discern and chart the mucus, the cervix, and the temperature signs of fertility. The great advantage over the previous rhythm method is that NFP method allows a woman to clearly discern her fertility and infertility in each cycle, no matter how long or short the cycle. Once learned, the charting only takes a few minutes and has to be done for only part of the cycle. Page 6. I am there now. Okay, page 6. Okay, I arrived. What about the man? He's always the problem. Okay? That's the truth. Okay? He's always fertile. Yeah, that's your problem, okay? Now, this is true, though. But if he wasn't, suppose he was only fertile like one day in the cycle, like the woman, okay? How in the name of God would we coordinate this? The one day, you understand that? So it's best that he's the problem, okay? Okay? Because if you had to coordinate that, we'd just fade off the face of the earth, all right? But on the other hand, we treat a woman like she's pregnant all the time. That's absurd. But that's what money, the multi-million dollar business of contraceptives convinces women to do. It's bad for their health, it's biologically. It's deceiving them in terms of the need. It's not there. And it makes the woman to be an object, not a person loved. The whole thing, it's destructive, okay? Okay, what about the man? The pattern of sex hormones in the male is considerably less complicated since the male hormones are not concerned with the developing embryo. The hormone testosterone is responsible for the development of the male secondary sex characteristics. The pituitary hormones are involved in the production of sperm. The sperms are produced in the testes and are transported by a series of ducts to the outside of the body. The seminal vesicles and prostate gland supply of fluid, and the mixture of the fluid and the sperm is known as the semen. At the time of intercourse, as many as 300 million sperm are transferred to the female. Unlike the woman who is fertile only on one day of the cycle, by God's wise design, the fertile man is always fertile. Otherwise, the human race would shrink away under the overwhelming problem of coordinating the rare fertile day in the man and the woman. Okay, you understand that? Now, how and who may use this wonderful powers? Whether a man or a woman marry or not, the procreative meaning or purpose of their sexual organs exist and is present in their bodies by God's design. So right now, that is how God made you. That's the cycle you go through. Whether you decide to get married or not, doesn't make any difference. That's how you are, you see? And it's to know how you are and respect it. So it says, whether a man or woman marry or not marry, the procreative meaning or purpose of their sexual organs exist and is present in their bodies by God's design. As the mind must be open for knowing the truth, the will for choosing good, the eye for seeing, and the ear for hearing, so the sexual organs must remain open for the purpose of the transmission of life. Moreover, since man is the union of body and soul, God acts each time a new human life comes into existence by the infusion of an immortal soul. Therefore, God's action must not be deliberately excluded, nor must God's design for male and female be frustrated. Before the act, by sterilization and the pills and the contraceptives, during the act, by physical and chemical contraceptives, nor after the act, by the IUDs, at times the pill and abortion of intercourse. The IUD is an intrauterine device. It's not a contraceptive. Whereas, if I have a splinter in my hand recognizes as a foreign body. It begins to contract. And eventually, it's gone. If it's really embedded, I have to pull it out with tweezers. Okay? When you put the intrauterine device into the womb, you put it against the wall of the womb, and the womb starts to contract, it recognizes a foreign body, see? Contract. So when the life is conceived in the fallopian tube and comes down, it can't implant on the side of the wall of the uterus because it's contracting, rejecting, you see? So it's just a pure abortifacient. Now sometimes when they put that intrauterine device in, they go right through the womb. Okay? There's blooding, there's hemorrhaging. It was so bad in America that they took it off the market as dangerous to the woman. So they took the millions and millions of the IUDs and they dumped them on the third world. So women out in the fields with no medical background, everything, using these things with all types of incredible, God forgive us, incredible. See? They brought them back recently. Beware. It's still the same thing. They're still abortifacients and it's still dangerous to the health of the mother. Okay? Okay. Now, moreover, since man is the union of body and soul, God acts each time a new life comes into existence by the infusion of an immortal soul. Therefore, God's action must not be excluded, nor must God's design for male and female be frustrated before the act itself by sterilization or by the pill and so forth, chemicals, during the act by physical and chemical contraceptives, or after the act by the IUDs. At times the pill works that way too. So the new pill on the market works double mechanism, stopping ovulation, but also stopping the development of the rich blood cells and lining of the uterus. So it becomes an abortifacient. Kids don't know that. We have people out there, pro-lifers, screaming to you, I'm pro-life, I'm against abortion. And they're home aborting their children, chemically. Don't even know it. Okay? Don't even know it. And then they find out, they say, my God. And they change. And they want to know the priest, why the hell don't you tell me this? It's interesting. I've known that. Well, if they're hanging around me, you're going to find out quite rather quickly. Okay. Okay. Who may use these powers? Who may use these powers? And they are powers given to you by God. Beautiful. Okay? God-given powers. That are by God's design ordered towards new human life, a person who is forever. You know, that mystery of sexuality is magnificent. Magnificent, you see? These powers can be used only by two people who deeply love each other and together are willing to accept full responsibility for their sexual actions, namely those who are in love and make a permanent commitment. This permanent exclusive commitment and exchange of the rights to each other's body is the subject matter of the contract of marriage. And this total loving act of surrender becomes the subject matter of the sacrament of marriage. In the light of the above, one can clearly understand the teaching of the Church on marriage as expressed by Pope John Paul II in his apostolic exhortation entitled The Community of the Family. The Pope declared to the episcopate, the clergy, and the faithful, what did he say? It's in quotes, this is what he said. He said, okay. Now, page 7, we're getting there. It's precisely by moving from an integral vision of man and of his vocations, not only his natural and earthly, but also the supernatural and eternal vocation, that Paul VI affirmed that the teaching church is founded upon the inseparable connection willed by God and the church. You got a pen there? And just check out a little bit. There's extra words here, okay? Namely, it should be, you can change it later if you don't have the pen. Paul VI affirmed that the teaching of the church is founded upon the inseparable connection willed by God and that which follows it, the church is founded upon the inseparable connection. Mark it out, okay? It should be willed by God and unable to be broken by man on his own initiative between the two meanings of the conjugal act, the unitive meaning and the procreative meaning. And he concluded by re-emphasizing that there must be excluded as intrinsically immoral every action which either in anticipation of the conjugal act, contraceptives, the pill, or in its accomplishments, the condoms, everything else, or in the development of its natural consequences, the IUDs, proposes whether as an end or as means to render procreation impossible. When couples by means, notice that he quoted what? Section 7, Humani Vitae. where Paul the Sixth said, you cannot make a judgment on the use of your sexual powers except in the context of the whole picture. Now you know how to use them. See? You can't say, oh, feels good. Feels good. That's absurd. I love him. I love him. Take him. No, anyways, yeah, the whole context, see? I mean, you can give him this, say, read this, I'll see you later. Anyway, when instead, okay, by means of recourse to periods of infertility, when couples, by means of recourse to contraception, separate these two meanings that God the Creator has inscribed in the being of man and woman and in the dynamism of their sexual communion, they act as arbiters of the divine plan and manipulate and degrade human sexuality and with it themselves and their married partner by altering its value of total self-giving. Thus, the innate language that expresses the total reciprocal self-giving of husband and wife is overlaid through contraception by an objectively contradictory language, namely that of not giving oneself totally to the other. I told you that marriage is what? Two people fall in love, they become sexually attracted to each other, and finally want to give themselves totally to each other, including their life-giving powers. Call that marriage. And suddenly we're using contraceptive, and you're not giving your life-giving powers. It's a contradiction. Contradiction. Understand? So he says there, thus the innate language that expresses the total reciprocal self-giving of husband and wife is overlaid through contraception by an objectively contradictory language, namely that of not giving oneself totally to the other. This leads not only to a positive refusal to be open to life, but also to a falsification of the inner truth of conjugal love, which is called upon to give itself in personal totality. When instead, by means of recourse to periods of infertility, the couple respect the inseparable connection between the unitive and appropriative meanings of human sexuality, they are acting as ministers of God's plans, and they benefit from their sexuality according to the original dynamism of total self-giving without manipulation or alteration. Between contraception and recourse to the rhythm of the cycle is a difference which is much wider and deeper than is usually thought, one which involves in the final analysis two irreconcilable concepts of the human person and of human sexuality. And finally, page 8. I just had like an explosion, you know? You ever come down in an airplane? You see, and it'll suddenly, the pops, you can hear? It just popped here. You see? I can hear myself almost. I'm almost humanized. Maybe by midnight I'll become humanized, okay? It just popped. That's great. See, I have little things that see, you take for granted. I'm happy because of a pop, okay? Positive benefits. When a couple uses periodic abstinence to conform to God's design, it necessarily becomes a source of blessing to them. Sexuality becomes a mutual responsibility. It's no longer a woman's problem. This new communication develops a deep reciprocal respect that makes it easy for the couple to teach and give moral example. A deeper understanding of sexual intercourse in its significance and fruition and fruitfulness becomes apparent. Selfishness becomes rooted out, and the fidelity of partners is solidified. The couple gets a greater sense of dignity because they are now in control of their own sexuality. NFP keeps romance in the marriage so that each cycle becomes a courtship and a honeymoon. What's the negative consequences? By not acting in conformity to God's design, negative effects will follow. The couple becomes at odds with each other or the church. The lack of restraint and the security of not being able to conceive opens the door to infidelity. The woman is treated as an object of satisfaction, thereby breaking the personal union of soul and body, thus striking at God's creation itself at the level of the deepest interaction of nature and the person. Real communication breaks down. The absence of romance and respect for God's design creates a lessening of the awareness of God's part and the role in the human sexual love of the couple. Physical harm is also possible. Divorce and separation become likely. It's interesting, people who use NFP have less than 1% divorce rate. In fact, Catholic and non-Catholic, those who use contraceptives, 50% divorce rate. 50%. Married people are called to sacrificial love. Autumn is the season of the year when all of nature is dying. Yet for many people, the rich foliage of autumn is the most beautiful time of the year. So we too probably never look more beautiful to God and to each other than in our dying and self-sacrificing. Thus it is that married couples no longer apologize for the sacrifices and the absence involved in natural family planning. They have learned from experience that what seems negative to others has truly enriched and beautified their marital relationship. When the couple, by the grace of the sacrament of marriage, deny themselves for the sake of the other, out of love, they are truly living and reflecting to others Christ's sacrificial love for his church. Okay, hold on to that. Read it again on your own, okay? It contains a lot of wisdom.